How do you picture the world in 2030? It's just a bit over 10 years away, but do you think you'll see major changes with how you live, work and play? One person who has been seriously looking into the future is Steve Sammartino, a futurist who has a number of predictions about how things might turn out. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Now, you have an assortment of ideas on what might happen over the next decade, but that one that really excites us is this idea of a regional renaissance. Tell us what you think will be happening.
Well, the one thing that we know for sure is the technology has always defined how we live, where we live and where we work. And so we can think of the idea that the car and the Model T and Henry Ford invented suburbs and the suburban rings around the city, and that the factory, you know, defined us living in the inner city before that. But what we're about to have is a work-from-home revolution facilitated via technology and a transport revolution facilitated via autonomous transport and VTOL, which is vertical takeoff and landing transport, which we'll all own, cheaper than a family car.
We'll be the Jetsons, finally.
Finally, it's here. We're actually really close to this. And so we're going to have a regional renaissance that no one saw coming. Because whether or not you work for a big company that might be based in the city, or you're a digital crafts person who does your work online and sells it anywhere in the world, or whether you live locally in the Northern Rivers or wherever you might be, for the first time in history, you can live wherever you want. And people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so we're really going to see a renaissance in regional areas, and that's going to be the majority of where the economic growth comes from in the next 10 years.
That's really exciting. Let's talk more about the work that we'll be doing living in regional Australia when this renaissance is happening.
Yeah, so the first part is that a large part of work in the modern economy is what we call information work, and already close to 70% of workers in Australia are information workers. Now, foolishly, many of those people, and I used to be one of them, would hop in a traffic jam for an hour every day in the morning and in the afternoon to get to a giant 40-store filing cabinet filled with people, otherwise known as a head office, and we would sit inside that and sit on computers next to each other and do this work, which really could have been done remotely. We could have avoided all of that traffic in that time, and we could do that work from anywhere, you know, with the NBN and 5G. And companies are starting to work that out, and they're starting to say, well, why do we have this incredible cost infrastructure and all this wasted time on the roads when we could have people working from anywhere?
Well, I don't know if the bosses really care that much about how long it takes us to get to work, but I think in the past, they might have been scared that they, you know, without us sitting in front of them, they don't know what we're doing. But in fact, now they know what we're doing all the time. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing, don't they?
Absolutely. And I think you hit on two things there. In the past, I don't think bosses cared so much about us being caught in traffic jams. But I think we are learning that the happiness of your workers is a big part of their productivity, and the ability for them to enjoy their life outside of work has a really good impact on the type of work that they do. But also there's dramatic cost savings. I mean, the truth of it is that if we have a distributed workforce, housing affordability is much, much higher in regional areas, living standards are higher, general health tends to be higher as well because of your access to natural resources. And smart companies are starting to work this out. And we could have a distributed workforce that are happier, and they'll be more productive, and it'll also reduce the costs of running a big corporate head office with hundreds of people.
Well, the real estate alone in CBD Sydney must be outrageous, but the real estate will change, won't it? It'll be data that they'll have to be buying space for.
Yeah, that's right. But one of the interesting things about technology and data is that we have this Moore's Law effect, and the ability to store data and get access to data is constantly in decline. It has this efficiency ratio that goes with it. So a lot of those costs and those informational costs come down over time. And it's almost like we've got this legacy thinking that we need to be able to oversee our workers on what they're doing. Well, we can know what they're doing now by their output online. And we need to sort of get rid of that legacy idea that being able to see people and have them in front of them is what we need to have work done. But we've also got the future of manufacturing, you know, short-based manufacturing using 3D printing and digital crafting tools a lot of manufacturing is actually going to come back to what are high-cost labour markets like Australia.
Let's talk a bit more about the work and how you see the value of human work will increase in value even if automation could do the job. They still need us for our creativity?
Absolutely. I mean, human creativity is where the value comes from in work. I often say that efficiency is for robots. And actually, the thing that is really valuable and wonderful is when something is done that is noticeably human. So there's two really interesting examples where we've seen the value of work being done by humans that we can all relate to. The first one is music. So if we listen to a CD, it's perfect in every single way. It comes straight out of the factory, or we listen to an MP3 and that song is the perfect rendition. Yet we will pay more to go and see that person do it live and sweat and be on stage and hear the imperfections. And maybe they don't sing that note perfectly, or the guitar, they miss a chord, but that visceral feeling that we get from a live performance, we pay a premium for that today.
Oh, don't you? I remember in my day, when I was in my 20s, it was toss-up. Concert ticket, $30, CD, $30. You get the CD forever, which, because recorded music was seen as more valuable, and you had to really think, do I want to listen to David Bowie for the next 6 years, or do I want to go for that one night?
Well, it's really interesting because it's been a kind of a reversal. Years ago, bands used to tour pretty cheaply because they made a lot of money out of selling records. Now what they do is they give away the music so that you can develop a fan base and get paid for the live performance.
Yeah.
But we see this on a small scale too, right? So if we think about a coffee machine and making a coffee, you can have an instant coffee, which is cheap, or press a button on a machine. But we pay a premium when we go to our local barista and watch them make it and make it with love and put a little love part in it. And so, you know, we pay up to 100 times a premium for a barista-made cafe latte in our local cafe.
And there's a communication element to that as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there's that socialisation. I mean, I spend a lot of time working in my local cafe. They know me. And we have this little microcosm here where what happens is once things get automated, we sometimes go back to something because it's human. So we see it with coffee. We see it with the slow food movement. And we'll see that with technology as well. And so even that craftsmanship that comes from, you know, a YouTuber going onto YouTube and doing their own personality and us seeing those, we use the digital tools to distribute humanity. When something is formulaic, we get bored with it pretty quick as humans. And so what the balance will be in the future is balancing efficiency and putting humanity on top of the technology. And the things that have that human element, we usually pay a premium for.
I'm really fascinated by your ideas around energy because it's such a mess at the moment. Our governments can't seem to come up with anything that the investors are interested in. We flip-flop around what we're doing. You see it very different in the future.
Yeah, so energy is one of those transition industries, and we're in the middle between a transition to a new form of energy and the old fossil fuels energy. And when you have that transition, that's when the government struggle to make the investments because they know that they won't get the return on investment. So we have a really interesting situation where I think that within about 10 or 15 years, and maybe even sooner than that, maybe about 8 years, basically energy generation will all be free via renewables. And the reason is that energy generation is now an information technology. And all information technologies exponentially improve as we move up the knowledge curve. And so solar, for example, has been improving at 22% per annum in terms of its efficiency. And within a couple of years, no fossil fuel can compete. And so what we'll have is this highly distributed energy, and your house will basically be its own power plant.
So you think batteries will come down in price?
Yeah, so they already are coming down in price. So the energy density in batteries and the price has come off about 80% in the last 6 years. And so already you can go off grid for about $10,000 to $15,000 and never have to pay for electricity again. But, you know, foreseeably within 5 or 8 years, you'll be able to do that for about $5,000, a one-off setup cost. And the batteries are getting more and more efficient, and we'll actually probably move to a new type of battery, like a graphene battery, within 5 years. It'll have 100 times the storage efficiency of what we have today.
So those overseas superannuation funds and pension funds who bought our, leased our poles and wires will be wondering why they did in a few years' time, perhaps. Look, we're probably already seeing the start of this one, but you think globalization is in the is on the way out. And it's not for the reasons that people used to care about it so much, in that they wanted to keep their own identity. It's more, well, how do you see it?
Well, I mean, there's twofold. There's obviously a lot of fear and politics. You've seen it with Brexit and with Trump having his trade war with China. But one of the things that will happen is deglobalization is, now that robotics are becoming so efficient and artificial intelligence, a lot of the things that went off to global markets did so because it was cheaper. We went and did manufacturing in China. We lost a lot of manufacturing in New South Wales and Victoria to go off to low-cost labour markets. But when automation arrives and 3D printing, all of that manufacturing can come back. Apple have already announced that they're reopening a factory in America now, because the benefits of manufacturing overseas, that's being eroded when you take into account the transfer costs and the shipping and the time. And then when we have robotics, manufacturing will come back to countries like Australia.
Well, you would think they would with robotics. Like, even, you know, we lost our car industry when the car industries were using robots, which I could never get. I'm talking to futurist Steve Sammartino. Look, technology, should we be afraid, or do you really think it will make the world a better place?
Absolutely, it'll make the world a better place. And one of the core areas that'll make the world a better place is diagnostics and healthcare. But technology is like fire, right? We don't just set it alight and let it take its own way. We've got to guide it with humanity, and we have to be diligent about how technology gets distributed. And just like when we opened the first factories 200 years ago and we had the Industrial Revolution, we realized that we needed occupational health and safety. And just like when we released the car and we all started to get cars in our driveways, we realized that we needed speed limits and road rules and airbags and ABS brakes. And that's what we need for technology. We need to embrace its power, but we need to regulate it and guide it so that it serves us and we don't serve it. And maybe take away some of the dangers with unfettered technology. Like anything, it needs a guidance from humans so that we can harness the power, but not have some of those dark sides that come with anything that is super powerful.
This scares me. Humans merging with machines, then becoming hackable. Explain what would be going on there, please.
Well, look, our species has been on a really long path to increase our ability to cope with a complex world. I mean, even our neocortex was a function of how we evolved as Homo sapiens, and our jaws got smaller when we discovered fire. So our body shape has always changed historically based on the technology that we've harnessed. It does seem as though our technology is starting to slowly enter our bodies. I mean, everything from the cochlear ear implant to hip replacements and so on. And within probably, you know, another 10 or so years, we'll start to merge. You can see computers are wearable.
$6 million man running through each of us.
Yeah, that's right. And I think more on a cognitive ability rather than functional, you know, body parts being mechanized. That'll be more through necessity. But mostly, I think, you know, the smartphone will enter our body.
Wow.
We'll have a neural lace, and we'll be able to log into the internet just by thinking about it, and we'll merge with the machines, and I think that's going to be part of our natural evolution. We might even have a split in our species. Some people who say, no, I'm not going to do that, and some who say, yep, give it to me. But it's going to happen.
Okay, sure. Are we going to dump social media?
I think social media needs to be regulated, just like television and radio and traditional media are, because there's so much danger with the algorithms. Look, personally, even as a futurist, I don't overuse it. I just use it for work, and I keep my personal life private. And I think that people are starting to realise that all the benefit is going to the social media companies, and I'm not sure how social media really is.
You see the higher education bubble bursting?
Yeah, it's very expensive. I mean, the thing that, with higher education is that we're no longer buying an education, we're buying a stamp. The truth is, unless you want to have one of those degrees which need to be ordained by the institution like medicine or dentistry or engineering, most of those other forms of education can be obtained free and online. And in fact, you can even go and log into Harvard and do a robotics course for free through their online courses. So the idea that someone would go into $100,000 or $200,000 worth of debt to get someone's stamp and say you know something, I think that's a bubble that we really should investigate on whether or not that's a good investment for our children to make.
Steve, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much.